Well, thanks, Greg and team. Great to worship with you guys this morning. As Pastor Steve said, we are family, and part of family is we worship together. We do life together. If we haven't met, my name is Rick. Love to have you come to our newcomers lunch. You can sign up at the back for that. Also, if you're a woman and you want to go to brunch with a bunch any Saturday in February, you can sign up. There's still a bunch of slots available there for that. And great as a family to study God's Word together as we're going through the book of Daniel. Now, a question I got for you as we start, have you ever had a dream that's been kind of life-altering? Maybe for yourself, for someone else? I remember back when my kids were in elementary school, one night I had a dream about one of the teachers at the school. And the next day, I phoned Sheila, and I said, I had this dream about this teacher at the school. And she said, what was the dream? And I shared it with her, and she said, well, what do you think it means? And I said, I don't know. You know, and I said, I think I meant to share it with her. And she's like, well, that's kind of creepy, you know, because you're a 40-some married guy, and she's a 20-something, and we're not sure if she was single or in a relationship. And so I said, well, why don't I just like write it out on a card and, you know, put it in the teacher's mailbox. And she said, oh, that's even more creepy. And I said, oh, but I feel like I'm meant to share this dream. And so I said, you know, I don't have any appointments at around 3:30 when school is done. So why don't you meet me at the school and we'll walk into the school. We'll walk down the hallway. And if we see that teacher, I'll share the dream with her. So I met Sheila after school. We walked down the hallway of this public school, and sure enough, the teacher came out. And I said, you got 5 minutes? And I said, you know, this may be kind of weird, but I had a dream last night, and it was about a children's storybook, and you're in that story. And so I began to share it with her, the dream. Then afterwards, I said, you know, how do you react to that? Is that kind of weird or whatever? And she said, no, my family's kind of into metaphysical, esoteric kind of stuff. And I said, well, you know, take the dream, and you know, I don't know if it's from God, but if it is, maybe there's a message in there for you. But a week or two later, she talks to Sheila, and she said, as a result of Rick's dream, I've broken up with my boyfriend. We were to go on a trip to Europe together, but I don't feel I'm meant to go now. And he's disappointed, and then she mentioned to Sheila, he's a lawyer. And I thought, oh man, I'm going to get sued, you know. Lawyer sues pastor over dream, you know, about his girlfriend, you know. And she did break up with her boyfriend. I ran into her maybe a year or two later at Canadian Tire. I see she's with a guy, and they've got a baby, and I said, hey, you know, and start talking, and I said, hey, why don't you come over to our home? And it was a Saturday, and they came over, and I thought, you know, I'm kind of getting to know this guy and thinking, okay, how does God, you know, involve himself in our lives to the extent that a dream about someone can affect the trajectory of their life? Maybe you've had a dream like that. I'd love to hear from you about that. Now, what about when the dreams don't come true? Like, I had a dream about Pastor Steve this summer. I was in Seattle. I dreamt, and I can still picture it well. Pastor Steve was on stage here with two other men. This place was full of people. It was all in Punjabi. It was a result after a murder here in Surrey. And Pastor Steve was praying in Punjabi. It didn't come true. Well, that may be a good thing, you know. Although our murder rate is up, as you heard this week in the news, 25% in Surrey. What about when dreams don't come true? What about when you're unsure? Like, I've had some dreams that I've wondered, are they from God? Or are they from Satan? Or is it just kind of my imagination? What do we do with that? We're going to look this morning at a story in Daniel chapter 2 about a dream. But we'll see in the end that it's actually not about the dream or the interpretation of the dream as much as it is about the God who gives the dreams, the God who guides our lives, the God who in the end gets the glory in our lives. So I invite you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 2. We started 2 weeks ago, Daniel chapter 1. Last week covered the second half of Daniel chapter 1, where the King Nebuchadnezzar and his men invade Jerusalem. They take these prisoners of war. They drag them back to Babylon. And Daniel and some of his friends are part of the 10,000 people that are dragged to Babylon. So Daniel chapter 2, let's pick it up. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, and he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will cut you into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Whoa, what's happening here to King Neb, eh? He's got this impossible request. He's asking for the dream to be told to him. And we're not sure, you know, if he doesn't remember his dream. The King James Version, those of you who have that, says, "This thing is gone from me." Now, that's not the best translation from Hebrew. So we're not sure if he's just forgotten the dream or if he's kind of testing his wise counsel to see, hey, you know, maybe he's gotten some bad advice from them or questionable interpretations of other dreams. And so he's like, "Hey, I want you to tell me my dream and interpret it for me." Now, it's a good reminder to us that all people have troubling thoughts. Right? You know, the rich and the successful, who King Neb would be, you know, he's the chief of this empire. He's got all kinds of wealth, all kinds of power, but he's still troubled. And he's got this troubling dream. And he says there's going to be no exceptions. If they can't tell him the dream, he is going to, what did I read, cut them into pieces. You know, so this is one cruel dictator. We don't get it from the Bible, but in an extra biblical reference, there's this story about King Nebuchadnezzar and some of his cruel treatments of people. And one of them was he would take people and tie them, their four limbs, to four strong trees, and then torture them, separate the limbs from the body. So this is one cruel tyrant. And he's promising there, "Hey, if you guys can't tell me the dream, I'm going to cut you to pieces. I'm going to bulldoze down your houses." He's got absolute power. He's temperamental. He's unpredictable. And he's asking this impossible request. Now, it's easy to look at Daniel chapter 2 here and think that it's about King Nebuchadnezzar. And although the chapter talks all about him and his dream, the chapter isn't about King Neb. It's easy to look at the book of Daniel and think, hey, this story is about Daniel. It's not. This story is about God. Chapter 2, the dream, is about God. The story of Daniel is about God. The Bible is about God. Your life, my life, is about God. God is the hero of our stories. See, God is the one who sends Nebuchadnezzar this dream. He's the one who distresses his astrologers and diviners with the interpretation, and he's the one who's writing the story, which is good news for you and I, right? Because when we face impossible situations, when we face difficult challenges, it's not all up to us. God is involved in your story. He's writing your story. You can put your hope and confidence in that. That God will create or allow certain situations which you feel you're between a rock and a hard place. What do I do here? But God will make a way for you, as he does here in this story. So let's pick it up. Verse 7. "Once more they replied," this is his wise counsel, "let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it. Then the king answered, I am certain that you are trying to gain time because you realize this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, there is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among the humans. This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends and to put them to death. So you got the astrologers, they're pleading for some leniency, but King Neb doesn't back down. He's angry, he's furious, he orders the execution of all of them. And the wise council, they make an interesting statement there in verse 11, where they say, what the king asked is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they don't live among the humans. Well, they've got it half right there, don't they? Well, the king and the contents of his dream can't be revealed by a human. There is a God who lives among the humans, and that is Daniel's God. And Daniel and his friends, they're destined for execution. Let's see how they react. Verse 14. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Now, obviously, Daniel wasn't aware of the situation there until he gets his execution notice. And he's like, whoa, I'm going to die here. And notice how he responds to Arioch. It says there that he, verse 14, he spoke with wisdom and tact. That's an approach we often see Daniel take throughout the book of Daniel. We see it in Daniel chapter 1 when he approaches the chief of staff and says, hey, last week, we've got to eat this royal food. Me and the boys don't want to eat the royal food. Hey, what about a third way, this 10-day experiment? Can we try that? And he does that with wisdom and tact. And we see that here in this story also, that he uses that same sort of approach. I think that's wise in this day and era. To put a picture of a congresswoman up on the screen there, Mark. And you may remember this congresswoman, newly elected, and she has made the news because she called President Trump the F word. And she hasn't backed down from that. And in fact, her quote is that she's speaking, quote, truth to power, quote. Now, politics is divisive. I get that, particularly south of the border. But I'm wondering if there's a better way than just inflammatory rhetoric like that. That we look at Daniel here, and he spoke truth to power, but he did it with wisdom and tact. And I'm wondering as Christians in the lower mainland, what would it look like to speak truth with power, but to speak truth to power, but to do it with wisdom and tact, whether in your school or in your workplace or wherever it may be. There's so many issues that are so divisive in this day and age. I mentioned some of those issues in the first couple messages, and we'll again tackle some of them in the book of Daniel here. And there's things that are so divisive, whether it's on social media or things, some of the issues of our day. But what does it look like to be like Daniel and to speak with wisdom and tact in a culture that's constantly shifting? And what would it look like for Christians to disagree without being disagreeable? Like, would that not be a powerful apologetic in our culture where you got people just kind of flaming each other and getting angry at each other, especially on social media? What if Christians were to disagree in a different sort of way? That, yeah, we can share opinions, but we don't, resort to the inflammatory rhetoric. That we can agree or disagree without being disagreeable. Think of Daniel. I mean, here he is. He's exiled. He's off in a strange land. He's been ripped away from his family and his homeland and perhaps castrated, and now he's in this Babylonian university of the occult, and yet he approaches the king calm and collect. Which may be part of the reason that the erratic king Nebuchadnezzar gives him some more time. Maybe King Neb recognizes something about him, and he gives Daniel more time. Let's keep reading verse 17. Then Daniel returned to his house, explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Well, that's an understatement. He's pleading with his friends. Yeah, you know, if he was calm and collective when he saw King Neb, I'm sure when he gets home, he's like, guys, what are you doing playing Fortnite? We got no time here. Look at this. We got an execution notice here. We're going to die tomorrow. We got to pray. You know, turn the Nintendo Switch off. We got to pray all night around this thing. You know, and they go into this this concert of prayer, recognizing that it's only God who can give the answer. See, we can say in our lives that prayer is important. We can say prayer is essential. But there's something about when we're desperate for God that truly moves us to prayer, right? And these guys here, they're desperate. Their life depends on it. There's something about that we know when we're waiting for that email to come that could change the trajectory of our life. Or we're waiting for the doctor's appointment that, again, could change our life. That just kind of drives us to prayer because we're desperate. In my own life, I wish I prayed more. I wish I prayed more with my wife. We do, sometimes. And often, it's the situations, whether it's in our family or in our church family or some health concern or something, that causes us to be desperate that we say, hey, we got to pray about this right now. And we just kind of go to prayer. Like I said, I wish that was more often in my life, that I would just have that poverty of spirit that Jesus talked about, that we know that we're desperate for God. That's the situation these boys find themselves in. Let's take a look at their concert of prayer. Verse 19. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are His. He changes times and season. He disposes kings and raises others up. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with Him. I thank You and praise You, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of You. You have made known to us the dream of the king. Notice who he's giving the glory to. Again and again we hear God, 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 or he, that this alone is about God. That's not only the theme of his prayer here, it's the theme of the entire chapter, indeed the theme of the entire book, that our lives are lived for God's glory. God's glory. He says there, verse 18 I read, he urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven. Or verse 19, then Daniel prays the God of heaven. And we see that expression used again and again in this chapter. I think it's five or six times. God of heaven, or God in heaven. That our lives are about God. That more important than the dream or the interpretation of the dream is that God would reveal himself. To know this God of the dream. And the verses I read there, there's kind of two main themes about God that I see that Daniel raises. Why don't we put verse 20 up on the screen there? Let's read it together. Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are His. Kind of two characteristics that he mentions again and again are, first of all, that God is powerful. Everybody say that word, powerful. Powerful, that God is powerful. That he highlights that aspect of God's character. That at the time, it seems like King Nebuchadnezzar is the powerful one. He's the one who's ruling. From all appearances on the human level on that planet, Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful one. But the prophet sees beyond that. He sees that behind Nebuchadnezzar is God. He's the one who sets up kings. He changes times and seasons. He disposes kings and raises others up. But Daniel sees that, God, for whatever reason, has raised King Nebuchadnezzar up. But his kingdom, his rule will come to an end. And that word times that's used there, it's used a couple times in this chapter. It was used back in verse 9 also. Times, the Hebrew there is very similar to the Greek word kairos, which we tend to say around here. Sometimes in our discipleship groups or in our ministry teams, or if you're talking with one of our staff, they'll talk about kairos moments. The Greek word there meaning, you know, God breaking into our lives. That as time is moving along chronologically, God will break in and kind of alter the direction or trajectory of our life. And this is kind of, like I said, the Hebrew equivalent of that. That God is the one who sets up the times that he can break into an individual's life or even a nation's life, and he can cause this change to happen. He is God. He is in control. And even when things seem unpredictable in our world, it's a good reminder that God is all powerful. And the second characteristic there in verse 20, and then we see in this prayer, is that God is all wise. Everybody say that word, wise. Wise. That indeed Daniel understands that wisdom comes from God, the God who knows all things, and he shares his wisdom with people. Even if people don't recognize God as being the source of that wisdom, it still comes from God. See, we can sometimes look at maybe the book of Daniel and think, oh, he's real politically savvy. He knows how to kind of approach, you know, let's say the chief of staff or Eric will read up in or Arioch here, that he approaches Arioch, you know, kind of real with common sense, let's say. But more than common sense or more than political savvy, it's God who gives him that wisdom. And like I said, whether people recognize that or not, God, the all-wise God, is a God who reveals the deep and hidden things, as Daniel praises God for. That God is the source of the dream. God is the source of the interpretation of the dream. God is the one who gives wisdom. Let's keep reading. Verse 24. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." The king asked Daniel, also called Belshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery is revealed about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and visions that passed through your mind as you were lying in the bed are these. As your majesty was lying there, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so that your majesty may know the interpretation, and you may understand what went through your mind." Interesting contrast there, eh? You've got Arioch, who goes to the king and says, "Hey, I found the man." Well, he didn't actually find Daniel. He's trying to take credit for it. Daniel was the one who found him and said, "Take me to the king." And then Daniel goes before the king, and the king says, "Hey, can you interpret my dream?" He's like, no, but there is a God who can. He doesn't try and take any credit for himself. A couple times there in that section I just read, he's like, God's the one who reveals the mysteries. God's the one who explains this. All the credit goes to God. And then we have in verses 31 to the end of the chapter here, kind of the contents of the dream. Now they say a picture says 1,000 words, so why don't we put a picture up on the screen and you can read it later for yourself. But anyhow, King Nebuchadnezzar's dream is about this large statue that he sees. And so the top of the statue is made out of gold, and that represents the Babylonian Empire, which is King Nebuchadnezzar's empire. That's what's currently the time period that they're living in. Now, that empire lasted from 606 B.C. up to 539 B.C. And no doubt, again, at this time period, people are thinking, wow, the Babylonian Empire, it's the most powerful. It is never going to fall. But 65 years later, it indeed does fall. Now, I realize for people living in that time period, they're thinking, 65 years, that's my lifetime. I mean, for those who got dragged, you know, into Babylon, they're going to die in Babylon. But from God's perspective, time is far different. And he's the one who sets up and disposes kings, as Daniel mentions in his prayer. And so we've got from the gold, it goes to this chest and arms that are made out of silver. And that represents the Medo-Persian Empire, which took place right after. They invaded, they took over Babylon, and that would last about 200 years. Later in the book, we'll read about this guy, King Darius. And that he was one of the rulers during that 200 years. Then we've got the next part. We've got the bronze, and that represents kind of the belly and the thighs, and that represents the Greek kingdom that would follow. And if you studied history in university or in high school, you probably heard of Alexander the Great. It would be the largest empire of the ancient world. And that Greek kingdom would last 185 years. Then you've got the bottom. There you've got the legs, which are made of iron. And you've got the feet, which are made of iron and clay. And they would represent the Roman Empire. Now, historians aren't sure, you know, the Roman Empire, how long it lasted. You know, it would start maybe around 63 BC or so. Some date it up to 500 AD. Some take it all the way to 1500 AD. Rome was perhaps the greatest and the most influential of the historical empires. I mean, we still have the effects of the Roman Empire up until this day. Now, iron, Daniel says in his interpretation, represents strength. That the iron, he says, can smash anything. That Rome was strong. They had this mighty army, they had this mighty organization, this mighty law. But the iron is mixed with clay, and the clay represents weakness. Now, we're not sure, you know, exactly what that means in the interpretation. Let me read verse 43 there. He says, and just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. Now, I'm not sure how to read into that. You know, it may mean that there's these dividing visions among people within the Roman Empire. And you got the toes there. And the toes may represent a future empire. And that's, you know, a big maybe. You know, it may refer to a 10-nation confederacy that will operate sometime in the future. Now, Christian people love to speculate about these kind of things. In fact, when I Googled, Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2, there's a whole bunch of slides that show up there, you know, referring to the European Union. Well, that's an interpretation, you know, and that is speculation. The book of Daniel wasn't written for us to speculate around end times, you know, and what the ten toes represent. And we'll see it in Daniel 7, where the ten horns are there. And again, people say, oh, ten, look at the significance of ten. Ten countries in the European Union, ten, you know. And we could create all kinds of end times kind of charts. And when I went to Bible college and seminary, that's what they had us do, create these charts. But like I said, the book of Daniel wasn't written for us to speculate around those things. It was to remind us that God is in control, that God is the one who sets up kingdoms and disposes of them, that history is, in a sense, his story. He's the one who's writing it. And no matter how bad things are or times are, and some of those kingdoms, like King Neb, were terrible times, but God is still in control. God is still overseeing that in spite of present appearances or present circumstances, God is still sovereign. God is on the throne. Now, I read there in verse 1 that this dream troubled Nebuchadnezzar. No doubt this part of the dream he's happy about because he's the head and the head is made out of gold. But we see something else in the dream, and let me read verses, 34. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, not by human hands. It struck the statue of its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, silver and gold were all broken into pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. So this unusual rock, it's not a human rock, it's a divine rock. It comes and it smashes down this statue, destroying it. In fact, you know, wiping it out, turning it into dust that it can be blown away. And then this supernatural rock grows up. And we see the contrast, verse 44 in the interpretation. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. And so we've got these contrasts. We've got the rock, which represents the kingdom of the Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ, in contrast to this gold, silver, you know, bronze, etc., these minerals of decreasing value, but God's kingdom will come and smash against them. And we see further that the statue is an object that's made by human hands. But that rock, as Daniel says there in the dream, this is no ordinary rock. This is a supernatural rock. It's not made by human hands or human energy or invention. This is God's kingdom. And Daniel speaks to oppressed people in his own time period or in future time periods that God will free oppressed people. That God allows kings, rulers to be set up for whatever reason, reasons that we don't understand, but God is ultimately in control. There are terrible things happening in our world today. Christians are facing terrible persecution. North Korea, the worst place in the world to be a Christian. Or the Middle East, some of those countries, terrible atrocities against Christians. Northern India, China, some of the things that are recently happening in China that, they're installing these closed circuit TVs around churches, having signs up in front of churches. No children under the age of 18 are allowed to enter churches. Some pastors have become prisoners as a result of allowing children or refusing to allow CCTVs to be placed in their places of worship. But God is still in charge, whether it's Canada, China, the Middle East, wherever it may be. And God's kingdom will expand like this rock and will eventually become this huge mountain. And that the kingdoms of this world will become like chaff, blown away, versus the eternal kingdom, which will endure forever. Now, does this rock represent Christ's first coming? Or does it represent his second coming? I'd say the answer is yes. You know, that somehow in the first kingdom, in the first coming, God's kingdom is inaugurated and it will reach its conclusion in the second kingdom. That God is in control of history. And it may be kind of like two peaks on a mountain and we're living in the in-between time. God is in control of history. It means we don't blame God when evil dictators rise to power. God will somehow use them for his divine purposes, just like he used King Nebuchadnezzar. He allowed him on the throne, but only for 65 years before he was taken down. And this chapter ought to give us a joyful confidence that God is in control, that everything is under his sovereign hand, that ultimately people who are suffering in this world can take hope in the book of Daniel, that yes, we long for justice in our world. We work for justice in our world. And I sometimes wonder, even this morning, I was saying to God, like, why did I have that dream about Pastor Steve this summer and it didn't come true? And I thought, well, maybe it's my longing for justice in our city. You know, that here we got the murder rate up 25% to this last year. And that I want to see God's kingdom come. God's will be done. Here in Surrey and Langley and Delta, White Rock, etc., in the lower mainland, as his will is always done in heaven. And so, yeah, we're meant to be salt and light people. We're meant to work for justice. But ultimately, our hope isn't found in laws or isn't found in which police force we have or moral crusades or anything like that. Our hope is found in Jesus as Lord. and that every person places their trust in Jesus. And yes, we live a salt and light, but ultimately pointing people to Jesus, because His kingdom will last forever. This story isn't about Nebuchadnezzar, nor his dream. This story isn't about Daniel, just like your story isn't about your life or my story about my life, as much as it is about God. This God who reveals the mysteries of life, this God who guides and directs, this God who knows the future, knows your future, so you can put your trust and your hope in that. And you can work building not an earthly kingdom, but a heavenly kingdom, and put your hope in that, that we live our lives for Him, that He would be glorified in and through our lives. And what a difference that makes, right? When we live in that way, knowing that God is in the throne. Now, friends, is He on the throne of your heart? And if He's not, why not? Because if you've got self on the throne, how is that working out for you? But God on the throne changes everything, right? It changes the dreams that you may have. Or changes the impossible situations that you may face in life. It changes your focus going to the doctor's appointment this week or going back to school this week. It changes everything knowing that God is on the throne, that you can rest in that and you can trust in Him because His life is about, your life is about Him. And what would it mean for us to live that way, to say, God, I'm going to live for your glory. When I go back to school or work this week, I'm going to do that for your glory. I'm going to approach my marriage, approach my family for your glory. That God, I'm going to live in all matters of life for your glory because my life is about you. What a difference that will make, friends, to live with that sort of a posture. Let's go to prayer. Let me just take a few moments. This great big God who controls history. Babylonians, Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire and all of their rulers and leaders and up to here and now. 2019, God has you living here. For what purpose? Are you living for His glory? It's between you and God. You talk to Him right now. All great and mighty, awesome, all powerful, all wise God. We recognize our kind of minuteness in this story. Your story, history that you are writing. And that kind of overwhelms us, and yet You care about our individual stories and the focus of our lives and our worries and concerns. Jesus, take us to that deeper place of trust in You. Oh, take us to that place of faith where we can rest well at night because we know that You're on the throne. Where we can go forward in faith into our week. Not fearful of situations or people, but knowing You're in control. Oh God, make us into those kind of people of faith in You. Because of who You are. In Your powerful name we pray. Amen.